Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, he's a GP in Kent, Dr. Bob Gill, and he's very outspoken about the privatisation of the National Health Service. He presents what he sees as the means, motive and opportunity for privatisation. A shocking diagnosis from Dr. Bob Gill. Then local freelance journalist Joanna Booth joins us. She's a blogger too, to talk about the Mayor Marvin Rees's faith advisor. She is now gone. But who was she, and did she leave because of embarrassment? Also, the Castle Park Bank. Well, most of us in Bristol here have gone past it at one time or another, but what is it? It's allegedly been persecuting some of the Lloyds Bank customers with something called bait and switch. In other words, they bait you onto a new deal and they switch you onto a much higher interest rate that you cannot repay your loan. We speak to alleged victim Carolyn Shires. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio, one word, .co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokescroft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
I'm Dr. Bob Gill. I'm a GP. I work just outside London in Sidcup. I have a small practice of about 5,000 patients. Myself and other doctors run it. And I became an activist for the first time in my life in 2012 when I realised the threat that the NHS was under with the legislation that was passed in that year.
Now, the general practice is where most people first come across. It's the sort of coal face of the National Health Service and the health system generally. So how have GP practices changed on the inside? Because we as patients have noticed a change, mainly which is it's much more difficult to get appointments within a short space of time and sometimes even to see your own personal GP.
Well, there's no exaggeration to describe the whole of the NHS as being in crisis, particularly emergency services and general practice. We know there's over 100,000 staff vacancies within the NHS, of which 10,000 are at doctor level. And the reason this has come about is no accident. We've had the deliberate defunding of the NHS since 2010. So if you compare historic budget increases of NHS spending around 4% since 1948. Well, since 2010, we've had an average of 1%. So it doesn't even keep up with medical inflation.
Okay, but what's going on in general practice? Well, you know, obviously there's been changes in the way the whole GP system works. Despite the lack of money, that has changed too. We've also seen GP practices closing, you know, just people just giving up going home because they just cannot carry on as a GP practice.
Well, the squeeze on the NHS has caused more workload to be dumped out of the hospital into the community. The lack of the vacancies within the NHS caused more pressure on those people who remain, and that pressure is forcing people out of the NHS. They're breaking, they're seeking early retirement, they're giving up medicine. So you have a fundamental shortage of doctors to deliver that care, and you can only take it for so long. And if you do not have the backup of safe, competent hospital services, well, then the job satisfaction also goes. So you end up providing a poor service, which is of a lower quality, to increasingly dissatisfied patients.
So can you just answer?
And you can only take that for so long.
Can you just answer directly? Why is it that we now cannot get a GP appointment within a short space of? Usually, you know, if you phone up early in the morning, you can probably get a GP appointment within a couple of weeks. But that's a big change from pre 2010. So what's caused that specifically?
Lack of money going in. Real terms cut in the incomes of doctors and massive increase in workload.
And have you seen that in your own practice? And how have you coped with it?
I've seen it in my own practice. I am currently having difficulty recruiting a permanent doctor. I still have the same number of patients I've got to look after. The patient group generally is getting older and more complicated. And the amount of work that is coming our way, not only from the hospital, but regulatory burden, inspection burden, requirements to meet appraisal specifications, all of these burdens are bubbling up behind the scenes. The patients don't necessarily realize it until they have difficulty getting an appointment.
I mean, without naming names, can you give me any specific examples of patients of yours that have just hit up against the problems at the GP practice and then had to go elsewhere, had to go to A&E, all that sort of thing?
Well, the government has provided quite deliberately other avenues for the patients to go. So you've had urgent care centres, you've had services like 111. So they've quite deliberately diluted the position of the GP within the NHS. So rather than valuing the continuity of care, patients sometimes choose to go to an alternative provision. So that's one aspect. I'm quite fortunate we still manage to provide relatively good access. But I know patients who do find it hard to get their GP will present to an urgent care centre or to A&E, sometimes with something relatively simple and straightforward that their GP could have sorted out, but sometimes as a consequence of failing services generally, they rock up to A&E.
So we've seen here around the Bristol area, we've seen the accident and emergency closing at night in Weston-super-Mare, which of course is a large area, particularly of retired people there. A campaign attempt to keep it open, it seems to be failing. And it does seem, Bob, as if even when people are more needing to go to accident and emergency because of the failures of the GP services, that those very accident emergencies are closing. I wonder if that's a picture which is happening right across the country, or is it just here in Weston?
Well, the other factor that made me become active in health campaigning was the closure of my local A&E and then the threatened closure of another A&E down the road, Lewisham Hospital. That's what spurred me into action. I could not understand how any government could rationally further cut services. But you must remember, to me and you, the NHS is fundamentally there to provide healthcare. However, to our governments, they're no longer there to provide healthcare. They're to provide profit opportunities for global corporations. Sick people are not profitable. So you're having a closure of needed services, and the sickest and the poorest are going to be left without medical care. That's what happens.
Now, we hear a lot from the Labour Party about privatisation of the National Health Service, and yet there is a denials from the government, now Conservatives. So where do you stand on that? Is there privatisation really going on? What the Conservatives are saying is that, well, it's not actually being privatised. We're just allowing private companies to bid for state-run services to allow a bit more flexibility for people commissioning those services in the NHS, which is a fundamentally nationalised system.
So the government will never admit what they are doing, because that will guarantee the failure of their plan. So they have to lie until it's all done and dusted. That's the first thing you must understand. Outsourcing is a form of privatization. There are no two ways about it. If the public are funding it and the private sector is delivering it, that is privatization by anybody's definition. And if you count outsourcing, if you count the ownership of hospitals, if you bring into that the cost burden of private finance initiative, if you bring into that the cost of running a semi-marketized NHS, the amount of money now bypassing the provision of care within the NHS is huge. You're talking 20 to 30% of the NHS budget is now flowing through intermediaries, through the banks, through private providers who are creaming off profit, and no longer is all of that going to the delivery of care. That is privatisation, and there's no other way to look at this.
What about companies like Virgin? I mean, we've seen them doing, making records in the 1970s, going on to doing airlines and trains, that sort of thing, telecoms, the internet, and now healthcare too. How have they been getting on?
Well, Virgin are having been dipping their toe in the NHS for some years now. What these private companies are interested in is cherry picking those services that are profitable. Now, Virgin Care have gone into community services and paediatric services and also sexual health clinics and urgent care centres. And there have been some horror stories. For example, the urgent care centre in Croydon, they were getting the receptionist to triage patients. The receptionist, medically unqualified person, to decide who is the sickest and who needs to wait the longest. And that led to a tragic death of a lady who died with multiple organ failure in the waiting room in that urgent care centre. The only way you can make profit out of healthcare is by avoiding the sick, doing the profitable activities, and when it comes to insurers, dumping the insured when they become expensive. There's no country in the world which runs a universal, comprehensive system in a private way and delivers similar outcomes as the NHS used to do when it was a nationalised service.
There are some people that say that the whole structure of the National Health Service has been reformed, and others that say, well, actually, it's still the same. It's just that private companies are now able to be part of it. So where do you lie on that one?
There has been a fundamental incremental restructuring of the NHS. You've had this bloated senior management structure that's been imposed on the NHS. The NHS hospital network has been broken up into foundation trusts. General practice has been split up into, first of all, clinical commissioning groups, and now they're being merged back into primary care networks. And these will be the building block of models called, they're called now integrated care systems, but they're based on the American model of accountable care or health maintenance organizations, which are partnerships between private providers and private insurers to maximize profit through the denial of care to sick patients.
So what is an integrated care system?
That is the British acronym used to disguise the fact that we're following the American model. But what it boils down to is merging GP practices together to gain control of their budgets, which are at the moment based on their list size, which is called the capitation budget. And these will be gathered together, as will the social services budgets be pooled in together. And once all this money is very usefully pooled, that control of that budget will be given over and is being given over to the American insurance industry, principally United Health, which is the biggest insurer in America, and their wholly owned subsidiary in England called Optum.
We do hear quite a lot, don't we, about social care and whether or not that should be integrated into the National Health Service. Governments seem to keep nearly doing something about that and not.
Well, the whole pattern of nudging people into a privatised system is predicated on creating a crisis for which you have a predetermined solution. So the crisis in social care funding was entirely predictable. We have social care which is almost entirely privatised and means tested. They already have a charging system. Well, can you imagine, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to work out, integrating that system with a health system will help to bring in also backdoor means testing and charging. They keep using words like integration because they sound great to the unwitting member of the public. The reality is what they want to integrate is the budgets. I come back to the key principle driving all of this is to hand over control of the budgets to the American insurance industry. Think of it like this. The NHS can be divided up into three main assets. You've got the land and the buildings. You've got the budgets, which I've just talked about. And then you've got the patient data. And already the control of all those three assets is very heavily weighted over to the private sector. That's why it's been divided up in this way. So PFI, Private Finance Initiative, effectively transferred ownership of NHS land and buildings to the private sector. A PFI hospital is not owned by the public. We simply pay a debt for 30 years, at the end of which we still don't own the hospital. This is a huge scam happening in plain sight, but we wouldn't hear it from mainstream media or the politicians in general.
What about personnel, Bob? Because that's one thing that would allow some sort of proper continuity back with the old nationalised system. The senior personnel, surely they are from that, you know, previous system.
When you mean personnel, I assume you mean the medical.
I'm actually talking about the senior people in the health service. So this is the people who are making the decisions, strategic, higher management, and even at the Department for Health, people like that.
Yeah, so generally speaking, anybody with a public service ethos who still believes in the NHS should be a public service, free at the point of use, funded through taxation, they are no longer there. Can you think of anybody in senior management who truly believes in the NHS? The rhetoric is there, but the reality is anybody who is a potential obstacle within the senior echelons of the NHS has gone. Even at a more local level, there's a continual turnover of senior managers. They come into a hospital trust or a clinical commissioning group. They're there for 2 or 3 years. They push through their cuts and closures and reforms, and then they move on, never to have to witness the consequences of their actions. And this is quite a deliberate policy. Without the compliant and fully complicit senior management across the NHS, none of this would be possible.
Whereabouts do they move on to? I mean, do they go sometimes to the private sector? Because this is one of the things that in all of the important strategic infrastructure that's government funded, we do worry about this whole rotating doors, revolving doors syndrome, where people are going into senior roles in managing public assets and then from there into private businesses.
Well, I'll give you one name, Mr. Simon Stevens, who was formerly Tony Blair's health advisor. In 2004, went over to United Health, spent 10 years there, left as the president of global expansion in 2014 to become chief executive of NHS England. And all the reforms he's putting in, all the restructures he's putting in, are modelled on the private insurance line. So if there was any exponent of the revolving door that needs everybody's attention, it's him.
Well, it's interesting that he's been working for a Labour government, because I understand that Sir Oliver Letwin, he's a Conservative MP and has been involved in the whole Brexit business quite centrally. He was he penned a document which proposed a way to privatise the National Health Service back probably 15 years ago or so.
Yeah, so Letwin not only wrote a pamphlet on privatising the NHS called Britain's Biggest Enterprise, that was back in 1988. He also wrote a book called Privatising the World in the same year. And that set out how to break up and asset strip all the public services and all the public utilities. And most of that has been done. The NHS has been the hardest to do because it's so beloved and trusted of the public. So it's taken them a lot longer to achieve what they wanted to achieve with the NHS, but we're nearly there. In fact, Letwin was caught off guard in a meeting and said within 5 years of the next Tory government, the NHS will be privatised. And he said that it should have all been over by 2015, if you take him at his word. It's taken them longer than expected because there has been a pushback with campaign groups fighting for their local hospitals and others raising concern. But you're exactly right. The blueprints were written by Letwin, John Redwood, and also the think tanks like the Adam Smith Institute, who wrote a paper called The Health of Nations, again, outlining how to get from a public service to a fully privatized insurance-based system without too many people noticing.
Well, yeah, you implied earlier, didn't you, that there's actually some deliberate deception involved here. You're a GP, Bob, but you're starting to sound like a bit of a conspiracy theorist.
Well, this is all evidence. The documents are there. In fact, I'm making a documentary about this very subject, and we've been working on it for a couple of years now, which sets out very clearly how this has been achieved, what steps have been taken, what assets they're after, and how the end game will be achieved.
Yeah, but how does such a deception and such a conspiracy manage to span several governments? I mean, we've had different governments, and you're implying here that the same plan is being followed by each one.
Well, I don't know if you remember Margaret Thatcher was quoted as saying, what was her best achievement? And she said, Tony Blair and New Labour. There has been a continuum of policy stream spanning successive governments, following, broadly speaking, what are called neoliberal policies, which are to deregulate, lower tax burden for the rich, and privatise. And that's exactly what we've experienced, not only in this country, but also in America, where you've had a trashing of welfare and protection of public's rights and entitlements, and you had a massive widening in the wealth gap and power concentrating in fewer and fewer hands. You only have to look around you and you'll see that is exactly what has happened over the last few
decades. I certainly couldn't deny that. That's definitely been happening, and you know, enormous amounts of wealth squirreled away in tax havens, completely tax-free, where the Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs can't get their hands on it at all. And so you end up with a situation where the richer you are, the less tax you pay. And there's something a little bit perverse about that. But look, I mean, you're implying here that there are people involved in the management of the NHS at the very highest levels who are engaged in destroying its reputation.
They are employed to force through top-down cuts and closures which will damage and kill people. That is what's going on. Don't take my word for it. The evidence is out there. The life expectancy in this country has started to decline, not seen in any equivalent economy in the world. Infant mortality has risen for 3 years in a row. Infant mortality is a very good, sensitive measure of how a health system is performing. And we've also had an estimated 130,000 deaths in this country as a result to cuts in health and social care. What more evidence do we need?
I mean, do you think that there are attempts also to persuade staff in the National Health Service, hundreds of thousands of staff, nurses, doctors, porters, everybody, to go along with this plan? Is that going to be feasible? Surely they will be fighting back.
The deception is key. You have to keep reframing things as reform and improvement. I think the penny is dropping in more and more staff's minds, but the reality is they struggle to cope with day-to-day existing. They don't have the headspace to try and get their understanding of what's going on in health policy. And if you watch the news on the BBC or ITV, nobody's telling you what's going on. So you have this cognitive dissonance between, you know, what you see with your eyes, the deterioration and the loss of safety of services, and hearing nothing on the news. So people's reality is saying one thing, but public awareness is saying something else. So the staff and the patients are paying a very, very heavy price, and that also explains why there's a hemorrhaging of experienced staff, which is, again, quite deliberate. It's called the legacy workforce. The government and the policy people and whoever's going to benefit from all of these changes in the NHS do not want experienced witnesses with organisational memory of how the NHS should be and could be run to remain within the system. Or if they do remain, they need to be kept quiet.
What about generally morale? I mean, at your practice and across the country?
Well, the people I speak to, certainly other general practitioner colleagues around my age, 50 plus, are looking for a way out. You know, if somebody could offer them a way out, you know, they didn't have mortgages to pay or university school fees to save up for, they would be leaving. And it's a desperate situation. I don't know. I haven't spoken to one health professional who feels that they're doing the job to the best of their ability and have got adequate resource to do that. It just doesn't exist. So morale is rock bottom, and that's why we have this massive hole in the recruitment and retention. Retention is key. That's the best parameter, I feel, to to gauge how good a service is run. And if you look at staff turnover, if you look at early retirement figures, that's where you get to the truth.
But surely, Bob, I mean, this job is its own reward. It's actually a very rewarding thing to do, to cure people and make people better.
It's very rewarding if you can do the job that you've trained to be doing. But if you've got patients in A&E dying in corridors because there's no intensive care bed, then that isn't so rewarding. If you've got patients screaming in agony because their pain isn't controlled, because you don't have a syringe driver pump to hook them up to some strong pain relief, that is not rewarding. That is actually destroying people psychologically very slowly. It's conditioning them to accepting poorer and poorer levels of care. So patients of mine, I have many examples of patients of mine that have gone to my local overstretched hospital who've been persuaded to go home for whatever reason, but underlying that is the lack of beds, lack of available beds. And I had a patient who came to see me last week who is actually a nurse in another hospital who was sent home with agonizing abdominal pain, and they failed to diagnose a strangulated hernia. Now, when that doctor or nurse finds out about this misdiagnosis, believe me, they will feel professionally guilty. And in some way, that will be psychologically damaging to them.
I mean, with all this going on, surely there are whistleblowers, Bob, out there that are coming and talking to journalists, etc.
There are whistleblowers. You get a few brave individuals who may, first of all, internally raise matters. But what normally?
Well, hang on. They don't have to be brave, surely. They wouldn't have, their jobs will be protected, surely.
Well, that's the official line. The reality is, if you raise concerns which are predominantly down to systemic failings, either lack of staff or lack of facilities, for which there is no political appetite to fix because we're seeing cuts and closures, they will be, first of all, ignored. That will silence most people. If they speak up a second time, well, that's already a minority. And by that time, if they're pressured into keeping quiet, the vast majority will. There are very, very few people who will persist and either go higher up the organization or go outside the organization. And believe me, I've spoken to several whistleblowers within the NHS. These people are crushed, often financially, because they can't afford the legal battle that they then embark on.
Where do people go to find out more about what's going on? Because obviously we're not getting a lot of this from the mass media. And I suppose even more importantly, Bob, what can we do?
So we have a website. It's called thegreatnhsheist.com. We've put quite a lot of resources on there. We've also got a YouTube channel to try and explain what is happening. Another website I'd recommend is the NHS Support Federation, which puts together quite a lot of good evidence. Unfortunately, there's a lack of legitimate sources which explain what's really going on in the NHS for whatever reason, whether they are holding back on being as blunt as they need to be, or some other nefarious powers are at work.
Well, listen, we've just heard about what happens to whistleblowers, so
yeah. So, and don't forget, we touched on New Labour spending 13 years facilitating this. Well, there's also an internal struggle within the Labour Party now, as we've seen with all the anti-Semitism row and other mudslinging. But there's also a tension in the policy, delivering the policies, and also that goes into campaign groups. So there are elements of campaign groups who are quite happy to do the bare minimum and let things plod along as they are, but virtue signal that they're all interested in saving the NHS. But the messaging is too weak. So either they are incompetent or they're complicit. Take your pick.
Or maybe they're victims of this demoralizing of anyone that's involved in the National Health Service. There could be that too, that they just get hit burnout.
Yeah, there may be an element of that. But my key thing in order to have any chance of putting a stop to this is for the public to wake up and realize what is afoot. And, you know, hence I'm making this film, and I made a film back in 2014 called Sell Off, which set out what was going on then. And we made some predictions about mass closures of GP surgeries and further cuts to hospitals. And unfortunately, they're all been coming true.
So, okay, so assuming that some listeners have woken up, and what can we then do? Is there anything that actually points of pressure that might stop this incredibly precious? I mean, it's something which was put together, I know, at the end of the Second World War, where medical staff had been dragging people out of burning buildings, bombed buildings, you know, aeroplanes, all this sort of thing, and they certainly weren't looking at how much money they had before they were going to get treatment. And this did bring people together in a way to form a health service, saying, well, actually, look, you know, we need to be treating our population rather like you would a family. So we're not asking questions immediately anyway about, you know, how much money have you got before we make you better. So what once people have woken up, what can they actually do, Bob? Where are the best places to put pressure?
Well, I think everybody who has got themselves up to speed needs to become a vehicle for amplifying the message. So do that in any way possible. Tell your friends, tell your family, engage on social media, interact with those sections of the media who are, you know, willing and able to listen, ring up talk radio stations, challenge the lies that are being putting out there, and confront the decision makers, the politicians who are putting themselves up for election again. They need to realize that the public, the voters, the taxpayers have rumbled the con. And whoever gets in, we must maintain that pressure and hold them to account in whichever way possible. And also interact with the local organizations, your hospital trusts and your primary care networks, whatever you like to call them. There are people on there who need to feel the pressure of the patients and the public to say, look, you cannot do this to us. We will not let you.
Oh, okay. Dr. Bob Gill, can you just please finally remind us of those two websites again and the two campaigns you mentioned?
So our website is thegreatnhsheist.com, and another reliable website is by the NHS Support Federation. So if you just search those, you should be able to find them.
Bob Gill, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Joanna Booth. I'm an independent freelance journalist. I like researching the city because I live in it and I'm interested to see what goes on.
Yeah, it's not a Bristol accent though. Where are you from?
No, I'm Greek-Australian. So
Greek-Australian?
Greek-Australian.
How does that work? So you've got one parent Greek, parent Australian?
No, I'm full Greek and I'm full Australian. So I was born in Australia to Greek parents who were naturalised as Australian. I also have a Greek passport. So I've also lived in Greece for a couple of years.
So what are you doing here? Greece is so nice and warm.
I'm not a warm person.
Okay.
I came to England for the weather.
But you've been looking into some fascinating characters that have been popping up here in City Hall here, haven't you?
I have.
Since the end of George Ferguson and the introduction of Marvin Rees. So
that's right.
Who is it specifically that has taken your interest?
Well, it's Marvin that has taken my interest. There was a fascinating entry in his diary in 2018 about him meeting with the senior associate of the Bethel School of Supernatural Ministry.
Supernatural?
Supernatural ministry. It was that word, actually, that caught my interest. And then I spotted that someone had put in an FOI request, a Freedom of Information request, about what the meeting was about. So then I saw another Freedom of Information request. They weren't by me. They were by someone called S. Thomas. And I thought it was interesting. I thought I'd just research generally in my leisure time of what this school was, and it's an evangelical ministry in Redding, California, and what the Freedom of Information request came back with was that the talks and meetings were about US-Bristol trade, and Marvin Rees's faith advisor was also involved. She had been at the meetings. One of the meetings was in Washington, and one of the meetings was in London at the St. Ermin Hotel, which used to be where the Secret Service met, and they're very close to the House of Commons. It's an interesting hotel.
Okay, so the faith advisor, I mean, one would hope that there was some sort of multi-faith element there, because obviously Bristol's got lots of different faiths, and of course none. But so who is this faith advisor, and are they multi-faith or one specific faith?
Well, it's called, I think it was a New Wine Conference in 2018. Marvin Rees introduced Rachel Milano, who was his faith advisor, as his advisor, and he said that she's his link to the Christian churches, the churches. He said, quote, "We call her faith because of the sensitivities. So I haven't seen any evidence of links to other churches or to other religious organizations other than Christian ones. There may be. I haven't researched that part. All I know of it is that she was a link to the Christian churches."
Okay, what about this Bethel School of Supernatural Ministry? Is she linked to that as well, or what? Is she from there?
Yes, turns out that she's a graduate from there. She was part of their three-year course of becoming a prophet. So the BSSM, shall we call them, the Bethel School of Supernatural.
So this isn't the sort of course you can do at the University of the West of England?
It's not a... No, not well. You can do it in Bristol these days, I believe, but you can't do it at University of Bristol or UWE. It's a course, this one particular, you have to go to California. It's 3 years. Part of it is learning to be a prophet, to heal the sick, to raise the dead, from what I understand, to do things that Jesus would have done, literally.
So has she done any of this? Do we know?
I don't know.
Are we all to ask her?
Well,
actually,
I've emailed her, but I haven't got a response yet. But I would love to talk to her.
How long
about
ago
it.
Did you email her?
A few weeks ago.
Right. So
no response. But it was at the Bristol City Council email address.
Maybe Jesus doesn't do emails, or maybe Jesus is on holiday for the summer.
It could be.
Or Rachel, anyhow. So do we know what sort of advice she's giving Marvin?
I don't know. All I know is from this conference that I listened to is that she has advised him about which churches to talk to, and that she has connected him to Bethel School of Supernatural Ministry, to the senior associate there, Chris Vallotton, because he knows some very senior business people in the US, and then they could link up in terms of trade and some other. I do know that she was involved with a refugee, so helping
people.
Well, I mean,
there's no reason why a church shouldn't be closely connected to big business, but it doesn't seem the natural connection to make. Most churches are supposed to sort of be caring for the poor rather than the super rich.
Yes, this was a surprising link, the US Bristol trade link.
What about churches here in the city here? Is the Bethel School of Supernatural, we should call it the BSSM, I suppose.
BSSM.
Are they linked to any churches in Bristol?
They are. They seem to be linked. Well, Hope Chapel in Hotwells, on their website, they say they are connected to Bethel Church in Redding, California. Chris Vallotton, the senior associate, has done conferences and workshops at Christ Church in Clifton.
Do we know what sort of?
Yes, it was a very interesting one. I happened to listen to all of it. It was
so is this up online or something?
Yes, it's up online. I've got a link to it in my article, sorry.
Okay.
And a part of it was the Kingdom Come. So it was looking at the way that Bristol could be transformed, how religion could transform it, and the ways in which that would look.
Okay. Woodlands Church as well, are they involved?
Yes. They.
So this is the one up behind the BBC up
that's
top
right.
of White Ladies Road. Yeah.
That's right. It's around there. I can picture, yeah, near, is it Belgrave Road? I think it's
yeah.
Belgrave Road. So Woodlands Church have a funding or created this charity, Love Bristol. And Love Bristol has created a ministry itself. It's called Release Academy. And they're based in Stokes Croft. And they also use the, as well as BSSM and other places around the world, they use the Bethel curriculum to teach prophets as well. And they're going into their second year, I believe, now.
But they're not just doing that, are they? Because they also control and they started up some commercial-type businesses, maybe not for profit, but anyway, they're commercial businesses, almost like beginning to replace shops as the high streets close down.
They've started investing in property and in enterprises. So Elemental Bakery, for example, and Stokes Croft and Habitat, and they also run a vintage clothing place, I think, or a vintage space. So they're spreading their activities, helping.
Okay, so what do you think? Is there any problem with this? I mean, surely Marvin's perfectly entitled to have a faith advisor if he wants to.
Yes, he is. Well, many people have. I think Barack Obama had a faith advisor. Theresa May had a faith advisor. The only problem is that I could see, because of course it must be important to have a link to your civic institution, such as the church, is that the BSSM, anti-abortion, they believe that abortion is akin to the gas chambers in Auschwitz under the Nazis, and that same-sex relationships, marriages, are a sin. So the things that they actually teach seem to be excluding people.
Well, yeah, but that's surely about a difference between a secular, you know, politics and the church, which has a separate set of values, surely. I mean, you can't really alter the church's values.
No, you can't. But the church aren't electable. They're not accountable to anyone apart from their congregation. They don't need our scrutiny, or at least people who don't go to their own churches. But in terms of a council and of a mayor, he is accountable to us. His actions do need to be scrutinised, and we need transparency.
So how accountable do you think Marvin has been compared to George Ferguson and previous administrations?
Well, I don't think that we even know. I don't know who he's accountable to.
That was local freelance journalist and blogger Joanna Booth.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Carolyn Shires, and I first had contact with Lloyds Bank back in the end of 2007, early 2008, when I opened an account with them to help to get a loan to help to finance a farm that I had, a 42-acre farm, which I kept horses and some exotic livestock on. And that I was first introduced to Lloyds there then.
So what were you planning to do with the loan, and what happened at that point?
I was actually planning to have work done on the farm, and also to stock with some exotic animals, most importantly, what they call Bojet de Poitou donkeys, which are giant donkeys with long hair. I'd also got llamas and angora goats and horses. And at that time, I had wallabies.
Did you have a business plan for all of this? And Lloyds Bank normally insist on that, don't they?
I did have a business plan, but I have to say, at the initial think it was quite strange, because although I was requesting help, I hadn't actually... I did a sort of business plan, but I wasn't actually going to set up the business. I planned to get the farm straight before I started the business.
So can I ask how much the loan was for?
It was for
$100,000. And what happened? What happened next? Did things go to plan?
They did, although with hindsight, I felt very uncomfortable after a little while. No sooner had things started to be set up than I felt very uncomfortable about my bank manager. He With hindsight, I obviously did feel uncomfortable. I had just reasons for being uncomfortable. As soon as I requested the loan, he tried to sell me business loan insurance, which I didn't want because I'd already got insurance from my previous employer. He tried to sell me the business loan insurance, and I was. It made me feel very uneasy, but I was really keen to get the farm set up and to get everything going. So I carried on. I met at my solicitors. I had the land valued, and even then I felt it quite strange because the valuation. I'd already had some money from Barclays, and they'd valued the previously about less than a year previously, and Barclays had valued the farm at 500,000. When Lloyds valued the farm, just about a year later, they valued it at £300,000, which I thought was a massive difference, and I didn't feel that was right. But my bank manager said to me, "Oh, don't worry," he said, "You'll still get money because the valuer is a friend of mine."
So just remind us at what year it was that you initially got this Lloyds loan.
This was December 2007.
One thing is that you have, at that time, I mean, even I can remember, I was signing on in 2007, and I can even remember my bank saying to me, "Do you want a loan?" There were banks were really, you know, quite happy to give loans to almost anybody, it seemed, around about, and this is just before, of course, the financial crisis, the bailouts.
That's right. Well, the bank manager had been going around the local farms touting for business, and that he went to my local feed store, and that was how I met the bank manager, through my local feed store. Because he was Lloyds Bank, and it was a big bank, I trusted Lloyds Bank, like most people would.
So can you just take us through, blow by blow, how you slowly lost your trust in Lloyds?
I went to my solicitors. My solicitor signed the paperwork. The paperwork was signed for the loan, and the charge was put through in January 2008. Paperwork proves that. But I have recently found, or I found out last year, that actually what I thought was a loan at a very good interest rate, my bank manager had fiddled the paperwork and I'd actually got an overdraft, not a loan, not the loan that I thought I'd got, which was a bit of a surprise. And I was kept on that overdraft for 6 months until May 2008, which, because I didn't receive any statements, I was unaware. I thought I was on 3% of base rate, and instead of that, I was on 14%.
So you're not getting any statements through the post, but, I mean, surely you could have contacted them at any time to find out what your balance was, couldn't you?
Well, unfortunately, at the time, my mother had come to stop for a short length of time, and she'd become ill. And she had a very quick onset of Alzheimer's. Her Alzheimer's had got very bad all of a sudden, and she ended up in hospital. So I found myself distracted from noticing that I hadn't actually received statements.
And it's strange, isn't it? I mean, you would have thought that any account with a bank, you get statements, don't you?
You do, normally, and I hadn't got statements, but I believe that that's quite common with other people who have complained about Lloyds. I believe that's not, I'm not the only person that
okay,
has
so
issues.
This is 2008. What happened next?
Everything was fine, roughly, until I had difficulties. The loan changed from our interest only to repayment. When it got to that, I found difficulty. I asked Lloyds if they would help me for 3 months.
So you were having trouble making the payments, were you?
I was, yes. And I asked Lloyds if they would help me for 3 months until I received money from from where I worked. I could take a leave pension, and I thought that gave me a lump sum, which would help sort my account out. And also, we were selling my mother's property because she was ill and I was having to struggle to look after the property. And then, therefore, Lloyds would then have been paid off. But they didn't... I tried to discuss that, and I was told by my manager that he didn't really want to know, and he was sending me to the recoveries, which I had no idea what the recoveries was.
They're saying they want their money back.
Exactly. But there was no discussion.
Okay, so how long after you stopped the repayments or weren't able to make the full repayments did that happen?
Well, everything was in the December, and by the March they sent me to recoveries.
Was that March 2009 or 2008?
That was in 2011.
Oh, okay. So we've been going for a few years now.
We had been going until the end.
That sounds a bit quick. So there's no discussion. A payment is missed, or a payment is only part made, and suddenly they're going to call the loan in. I mean, that doesn't sound normal.
No, but it does seem to be normal for Lloyds. I know that I'm certainly not the only person that has had that.
Okay, so once you were with the recoveries unit, what happened then?
Well, I'm supposed to have been contacted by them, but I didn't hear from them until the June of 2011. And then I tried to discuss with them, and I said that I wanted to pay them back, that I wanted to sort out the account. What I didn't realise was, and also, the PPI policy had been put on. I tried to get them to cancel the PPI policy, and they would not cancel the PPI policy.
Well, these have been admitted now to be fraudulent, haven't they, PPI?
They have. I mean, that was £15,000 added to my account.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that is Dr. Bob Gill, local journalist Joanna Booth and Carolyn Shires, and also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, now on 0117 909 6897, online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in the UK via the National Volunteering website do-it.org. So, thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m, inshallah. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Search. someone who cares about you the way I do. Oh, I'm not bragging on myself, baby, but I'm the one who loves you, and there's no one else, no one else. You'll never find, it'll take the end of all time, someone to understand you like I do. You'll never find the rhythm, the rhyme, all the magic we shared, just us two. Oh, I'm not trying to make you stay, baby, but I know somehow, someday, some way, you are
gonna miss my loving.
You're gonna miss my loving.
You're gonna miss my loving.
When it's cold outside,
you're gonna miss
my love. Never find another love like mine. You'll keep searching and searching your whole life through. Oh, I don't wish you no bad luck, baby, but there's no ifs and buts or maybes. You're gonna miss my loving.